Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier, longer, and happier. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician and scientist specializing in lifestyle-based disease prevention and management and applied well-being. In today's episode, we're combining two areas that I'm passionate about: precision medicine, specifically using biological age testing, and lifestyle medicine. I'm joined by Dr. Matthew Dawson. Dr. Dawson attended medical school at the University of Kentucky before completing his residency in emergency medicine at the University of Utah, where he served as both chief resident and fellow. After practicing medicine and serving as an associate professor at the University of Kentucky for 7 years, Dr. Dawson developed a deep interest in genomics and epigenomics, realizing their potential to revolutionize our understanding of health and longevity. As the CEO of True Diagnostic, Dr. Dawson leads the company's mission to advance the science of epigenetics and provide groundbreaking insights into aging and disease prevention. His dedication to optimizing human performance, which began with his personal focus on fitness and nutrition, has evolved into a professional pursuit of harnessing epigenetic data to extend health span and improve overall well-being. Under his leadership, True Diagnostic is at the forefront of epigenetic testing and research, empowering individuals and researchers with actionable information about biological aging, disease susceptibility, and personalized health strategies. Dr. Dawson's passion for using cutting-edge science to impact lives is evident in his efforts to bridge the gap between epigenetic research and practical healthcare applications. Matt, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, we share so many interests, and we were talking about a little bit before. I run the executive health program here, have a strong interest in lifestyle medicine, of course, in precision medicine. And we've been really doing some clinical trials using some of these biological aging markers. So getting your insight is going to be a real treat today. And so, Matt, I want to start with kind of like a 50,000 foot level of where you think we are in terms of medicine and our capability, because we've both been in healthcare for quite a while and we've seen an evolution really of what we can offer our patients in terms of how we can diagnose disease, how we can tell people their trajectory, right, of where they're headed in terms of how they're aging. How would you describe where we are now in this moment of time?
Sure. Yeah. When I think about it, like one of the terms that's kind of out there now that I think Peter Thiel has helped promote is this medicine 3.0. I think we are moving into a time where we can be much more precise and personalized because we have the data to do that. And it's evolved over time, but now we're at a point, especially with AI as well, where we can take an incredible amount of data points about someone and really personalize all of the advice, whether we're talking about medications with pharmacogenomics or we're talking about the lifestyle things like that you and I are both interested in, like diet and sleep and exercise. We can actually get very personalized with that. So I think the genetics and the epigenetics are really incredible tools to be able to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we really, unlike any other time in human history, have this ability to understand our bodies. And it's also ironically, you know, one of the hardest times, I think, for people to access healthcare. So having this ability and making sure that people can benefit from it is particularly important. I want to start talking about the aging testing specifically. A lot of the aging is done through a term that I think people are familiar with, but if you don't mind explaining of what epigenetics are and how we have this capability of doing a deep dive.
Yeah. So to go back in time a little bit, about 6 years ago, I was in a university like you are, and I ended up leaving the university and starting a company focused very much on precision medicine. So in this company, what we would do is every patient that we would see, we would sequence their DNA, do a ton of blood testing, a lot of other testing to kind of make precision recommendations. So when we sequence someone's DNA, that's your human operating system. So that's genetics. That doesn't change. And also, it only accounts for about 20% of your health outcome. Your DNA is not destiny. It's about 20%. The other 80% is epigenetics. And what you do to turn those genes on or off, what you eat, how you sleep, your stress levels, what you're exposed to, is constantly modifying the gene expression, turning it up and down. And that is epigenetics. And we can now measure that. So historically, we've looked at biomarkers, your blood tests, your lipids, your CRP for inflammation, your hemoglobin A1C for metabolic health. And those were kind of epigenetic markers, meaning like based on our gene expression, we get these outcomes. But we can actually measure those exact genes and how much they're turned up and turned down. So when you and I are talking about epigenetics right now, I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about epigenetic testing. At True Diagnostic, with our biologic age clocks that we use, we look at almost a million specific gene CPG sites to look exactly how much is each one turned up and how much is turned down. And from that, we can impute an incredible amount of information. For example, your biologic age or your pace of aging.
Matt, I want to kind of break that down just a little bit. So if a person eats, say, a lovely salad, how does that salad get to how my genes are expressed?
Sure. So everything we do, and an interesting thing is like even the people listening to this right now, how they're perceiving it, whether they're annoyed by how I talk or whether they're soothed by it or whether they're excited about it. Even that is causing cascades, hormonal cascades in our body, surges or drops in epinephrine and dopamine. And all of those things change our gene expression. So when you take something like food, you can think of, well, the way I think about food is people understand if you take a medicine or a supplement, that's a molecule that then has effects on gene expression. It's the same thing for food. Our body breaks the food down into its constituent molecules, and those have an effect on the expression of genes. A gene like APOE4, which puts you at higher risk for dementia and cardiovascular disease, well, you're at higher risk, but what you eat affects the expression of that gene and how much it's turned on or not. So modifying your diet, if you have an APOE4 gene, to have less refined carbohydrates, less sugar, less saturated fat is going to decrease your chance of getting those diseases like dementia and cardiovascular disease.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you just mentioned, everything I'm thinking, let alone saying and then doing, is impacting my gene expression. So over my lifetime, it's really like in real time altering my gene expression. For some people, that may actually be kind of frightening, especially if we haven't always been good to our bodies. And for other people, that may be good news. But if a person is listening and says, okay, the past is past and going forward, I am going to adopt healthier habits, what is their ability to modify their epigenetic profile and what time frame can they realistically see a change in their risk of, like you mentioned, for dementia, if it's APOE4 or any other chronic disease?
Yeah, so I think this should be empowering for sure, not frightening for those listening to this. Just to give you a concrete example, my mother, when we tested her gene, she had an APOE4 gene, meaning she is 2 to 3 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease. And her mother had done it, and she just kind of lived through this. But when I found this out, what I told her is, Mom, this is great news, because we now know you have this risk and we're going to do something about it. We put her on our program, Signature DNA, looked at her blood work, and then put her on a very specific diet, exercise program, changed everything that she was doing. And in 3 months, she lost 40 pounds, reversed her insulin resistance, said that she felt 20 years younger. And we did modify and change her future. We drastically reduced her risk of getting dementia. And this is the power that we have. When we get this information, it should certainly be empowering because, like I said, 80% of our health outcome is about what we do in the epigenetics, and it's not the genetics. We have a lot of power and influence in that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I always tell people, as I told one of my patients this morning, is, you know, you're on a certain train and you kind of know where this train is going because maybe you've seen parents or other relatives on that train and you know the stops. But this is really your opportunity to get on a different train and create a different destination. So yeah, it's very empowering. In terms of epigenetics and testing for biological age, and you mentioned when we do a vial of blood, you may be able to do it in less. And we get the pattern of how these epigenetic changes have modified the DNA. And can you talk us through how these biological age calculations are derived with the combination of machine learning and how exactly we give people this number that we call the biological age?
Sure. Yeah. And so in the way we do it is just a few drops of blood on blood spot card. So just to mention that specifically on the sample. And I like the word that you said is an important word, the pattern. So that's what we're looking at for. So what can you tell with epigenetics and DNA methylation testing? So the fact that we're looking at a million different gene sites, and how much they're each expressing, how much they're turned up or down, how much they're hypo or hypermethylated. That's a lot of information. So from that, for example, there are studies showing that if I were to ask you how much you've smoked over your lifetime, and you tell me, and I get a few drops of your blood and test it, I can actually be more accurate than your self-report. Like, we can tell what zip code people spent most of their life in based on these epigenetic patterns. And so you think about a disease, for example, as well. So for something like neurosyphilis, that's a very difficult diagnosis to make. It's a lumbar puncture, a spinal tap. So it's complications. It's expensive to send someone to the hospital, and it's painful. Well, there's a study going on right now. We don't have the results yet, where we take several hundred patients with neurosyphilis, several hundred controls, look at those million sites and how neurosyphilis is changing the expression, and then find the pattern of neurosyphilis, and potentially then have a few drop of blood test instead of a lumbar puncture by finding that pattern. So it's the same with aging. When we have large data sets of patients, and we can measure how fast or slow they're aging by when they die, when they get different diseases and morbidity, and you have a really nice cohort, for example, the Dunedin PACE cohort, which you said you all are doing some studies with that. In that cohort, they studied for decades, this group. They identified the ones who were aging faster or slower. And then by having the blood and looking at their DNA methylation, they can identify the patterns of what is faster or slower aging in those cohorts. So that's how we derive this biologic age or pace of aging, which I think one thing to say about the biologic age tests, clinically for me, even 2 years ago, I didn't have a whole lot of utility for the biologic age tests in general, especially the original clocks, because if I see someone and they're chronologically 40, if they're biologically 36 or 44, I'm still just going to try to optimize them. And most of that result is from the past. What I love about the PACE test is you get a pace of aging, and I like that for two reasons. One, it tells me how you're doing now. So if you had a really pretty rough 20s, but you're dialed in now, I want to know how you're doing now. And what I love about the PACE also is it's responsive to intervention. So there are studies showing that if you get pregnant, which is a physiologic stress, your rate of aging goes up 20%. It comes down after you deliver. If you have a car accident, get COVID, hip surgery, your rate of aging goes up. When you recover, it comes down. So what that allows me to do as a clinician, and a patient could do this as well, is I can do interventions and see how it changes this really great integrator of your health, which is pace of aging. So Stanford just did a twin study where they did omnivore versus vegan diets. And in 8 weeks changing their diet, they found reductions or accelerations in their pace of aging. So if someone comes to me and says, I want to do IV stem cells in Panama, and it's going to cost $50,000. Well, I don't have a good measurement for that. Like, is it going to work or not? And I want an objective measurement. So I may do a PACE test before and a PACE test after to get some sort of idea of, is there an effect here? So that's why I really like the pace of aging more than most of the traditional biologic age clocks.
And I want to spend some time differentiating the clocks because, like you said, methodologically, you're looking at these epigenetic changes and you're training through machine learning or AI how you're essentially interpreting that data through these algorithms. There are different generation clocks. And then the reason I want to maybe break down the different types of clocks is because there are a lot of companies that do different biologic age testing. And I think if you are a consumer trying to reach out to companies, the methodology is so different. Like, I've tested mine through various companies and I've gotten an 11-year variance between the companies. One said I was ahead of accelerated aging. One said I was way below and aging far better, you know, at a biologic rate. And there's just such a wide spectrum. And that's, as we'll talk about, they're testing different things, even though as a consumer, they sent me literature that this is your biological age. Can you talk a little bit about how the clocks are different? And then maybe we can talk about how the Dunedin PACE clock is a little different that you're talking about now.
Yeah, anytime you order any test, there are kind of a few criteria, and you got to know why you're ordering them, what you're interested in. So a lot of the first clocks, like the first original Horvath clocks and all the first generation clocks, were trained to predict chronologic age. So they're not even really trained or supposed to be used for biologic age, and some people are still using them. Clocks that are trained to predict biologic age, well, they need to be good. 90% of what's out there, I think, is not good. First off, there have to be published studies on them. There's no published studies on an algorithm or a clock. There's no reason to use it. You can't trust that. once you start looking at the published studies, what you'll find is some of the earlier clocks, the precision, which is important. So you said you're accelerated or decelerated these different clocks. Well, if you sent the same tests back to the same company, two in the same day, a lot of those would be different. So in the original clocks, the average variance was around 4.5 to 5 years. That's not useful to me as a clinician. If I get a clock and then a year later, I measure again and you're 3 years younger, have I done something good or is that standard error? It's within that 4 years. So we use a measure called ICC or interclass correlation to see how precise. And they have this for regular labs, like your lipids, less than 5% variation is considered fine, American College of Pathology. So that's why also that I like the Dunedin PACE. I didn't get into it because it's more technical, but it has a really tight ICC. It's only, the variation is just a few percent with it. So you need a test that has a tight intraclass correlation, it's precise. You also need tests that actually predict what you want to predict, which is the reason we care about aging is because it's a number one risk factor for all disease. So if a biologic age clock is not better at predicting your death than chronologic age, we know our birthday, so it's not really helping us. Also, if it's not better at predicting morbidity, like cancer, heart disease, all these things, then it's not necessarily useful. It's just a number. And there's really four clocks that have been shown to be better predicting death and morbidity. And those are one developed by Harvard, which is the OMIC MH test. One developed by Yale, which is a Symphony Age test. The Dunedin PACE, which was developed at Duke, which is the one that you and I were talking about. And then Grim Age 2. So the original Grim Age that didn't perform well, but a Grim Age 2 clock does. So those are the four that give me the information as a clinician to say these are a useful test. But the PACE has the tightest interclass correlation, the most precision, and it's the one that is responsive to change quickly. And so that's why I prefer and like it.
Matt, when a person is also having a choice between picking these different biological age tests, some of the ones you mentioned are going to give a biological age. Like if you get your Grim Age, it's, hey, you are, say, chronologically 50 years old, but your biological age by this Grim Age calculator may be 44, but it's still giving you a biological age, whereas the Dunedin PACE is giving the rate of aging. Can you explain the difference between that and hence the difference in the utility?
For sure. So to use that example, if someone's chronologically 50, the biologic age clocks may say you're 45 or 55, aging more quickly or slowly. What the PACE would give you is a number between 0.6 and 1.4, with 1.0 meaning you're aging at the exact rate we would expect you to. If you're aging at 0.9, then you're aging 10% slower than most people your age. And so that's great. And if your score is 1.1, then you're aging 10% faster. We should try to bring that down. But that's the difference in how they're given. It's just an absolute number for the biologic age or this ratio of anywhere between 0.6 and 1.4 for your speed of aging with PACE.
And if a person gets a result back and one of them is a biological age that says, for example, they're a year or two ahead or behind versus the rate of aging with the Dunedin PACE, and that person says, okay, I'm going to change my diet, I'm going to change my fitness routine, which do you think is going to be more helpful for them to be able to interpret whether their change has made a difference? And that may also help us understand the importance of the rate of aging.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll use myself as an example. I, in my 20s and 30s, I went through medical school and residency and your 8-hour work weeks, and then did shift work for a long time in emergency medicine, and that shift work and not sleeping and those long hours and the stress, that really accelerates your aging. I also have 4 kids, so that probably did a little bit too. And so if I do my biologic age test, my global number, even though I feel like now I'm doing most things right, I exercise at least an hour a day, I eat very healthy, and I get plenty of sleep, I do the things, that biologic age clock, I did a lot of damage before. So if I get a number back and I say I'm 43, if I get the number back and it says I'm 42 or 44, well, that may be because I did all this damage, but now I'm doing good things. And if I do interventions now, I'm going to be able to have less effect on that global number because it's a result of the last 40 years. And so 3 months of change is probably not going to show me a lot. However, the PACE is looking at a moment in time right now. How am I doing? So I do a pace probably once a month. It's a little overkill, but I'm always doing something different, whether I'm taking rapamycin, I'll do a 2-month trial of that, see how it affects my pace of aging, or a new senolytic molecule, or I'll change my diet or something else like that. And you can see, like I mentioned, the Stanford study, them changing their diets. 8 weeks of a new diet, they saw a difference. So with the pace, you have more precision in seeing how are the interventions you're trying now, the things that you want to try for yourself, what kind of effect they're having. You're going to see that more with the pace. And we see it with patients all the time. It's not uncommon to get a 10% reduction, which is big, or even a 20%. We have some people, maybe familiar with Brian Johnson. He's very public about everything that he does. And he does a lot of pace testing, and he's been public about this, so I can talk about it. He's got his all the way down to like 0.67 now. So he's aging 2/3 of normal, which means over 30 years, he's only going to age 20 years. He'll extend his health span by 10 years for every 30 years. So the pace allows you to have that kind of precision and really do N of one experiments for yourself and see what works for you personally.
Can you walk us through results as you've just started to do? So if a person gets back a certain score, you know, I think a lot of times people get a certain score. A lot aren't in the types of practice that you have built or that you and I have built that can walk them through. What do you need to do? Like, how do you utilize this information towards your health? And they're left to either get some type of standard advice, you know, which it has a lot of benefit because in the end, we're all humans and we don't differ inordinately, you know, in how our makeup is. But then there's certainly some specifics. Can you walk us through, like, when you do this testing on yourself or on a patient, like how you utilize the data and nudge the needle, if you will, towards a slower rate of aging?
Yeah, I think there's three ways to do this. We'll go from like the most robust to the lowest tech. So one way would be to find a concierge physician or a lifestyle medicine physician like yourself or like me who can get this rate of aging and then can look at everything else. Like I look at the genetics, your lab work and all that, and find like, what is the reason you're aging faster or slower? Like, do you have really elevated hemoglobin A1C, so your metabolic health is out of whack, is your CRP or your inflammatory markers through the roof? Well, like, let's investigate what that is. So you can work with a physician or someone to identify the big things for you. So that would probably be the most robust way to work with someone who can design those N of one experiments with you. And like, we're going to focus on this for 3 months and we're going to retest. The second way is, so recently at Wild Health, we built all this IP, this AI engine to give the recommendations. We just recently actually turned that into an app and built it on top of a large language model so that people could interact with it without having a physician, at least the lifestyle components. So we have an app called Hollis, it's H-O-L-I-S, where you can order your pace test or labs or genetics or things, and then you can interact with it and you can actually tell it like, hey, I want to reduce my pace of aging, design a meal plan for me, looking at all of my data for the next 2 months. How should I eat? And then you could do a test before or after, and you can ask it questions daily. Like, I just gave a talk in Nantucket a few days ago. And when I was there, I was interacting with it and I said, hey, I'm staying at the Westmore Club, recommend lunch for me. And it just like ChatGPT, it pulled up a restaurant a quarter mile away. It recommended a very specific dish because it knows my genetics. I have a FADS2 polymorphism. It knows my labs. My hemoglobin A1C was a little higher than I'd want it recently. And it's tracking all my wearables. So it knew that I'd done a 30-minute swim and a 30-minute run that day. So it recommended some complex carbohydrates for recovery. So we have an app that kind of helps people do that on their own. And then the last kind of least robust way with no technology, no people, is to focus on the things that we know matter, like sleep. And actually, if you're going to start a new routine and try certain things around sleep or exercise or nutrition, then track it, like get some objective measures. And so design your own N of one experiments based on what you think would work, but actually get an objective marker instead of just doing it forever and not knowing if it made a difference or not.
And Matt, is the app that you mentioned, the Hollis app, is that available to people in general or only people in your practice?
No, actually, so with our practice, my issue with it, Sharon, was always that I grew up in poverty. And so it was just very expensive, like to get all of this done. And so that's always been my issue. I wanted to create an accessible way to kind of precision health, not medicine. Yeah, I can't practice medicine, not doing diagnosis or anything like that. But we just released it. It's available in the iOS App Store. for tens of dollars instead of hundreds or thousands of dollars, like really robust care is. So yeah, it's in beta right now. It's in the App Store. Yeah, that was a real example for me just using it. And it also is proactive. So it'll, like it, a week ago, it sent me a message and said, because it's also tracking all your wearable data, your sleep, your exercise, your nutrition. You're just talking to it, tell it what you ate, and it tracks all your macros. So it sent me a message saying, hey, your heart rate variability has been really low, but your exercise intensity is going up. I think you're overtraining. And when I stopped, I was like, I totally am. I've been traveling. I'm stressed. I tend to work out more when I'm stressed. And oh, actually, my back's hurting a little bit. My right rotator cuff is bothering me. And so I said, I am overtraining. And so then I said, well, design a workout plan for the next week to help me recover, because I'm not going to stop working out. I need that for like my stress reduction. And it knows my goals. So it knows my two main goals right now. I'm going to climb a mountain in a couple months. And so my goals are to lose 10 pounds without losing muscle mass and to improve my pickleball game. So it gave me a workout that would continue along those goals, but give me time to recover, my back to heal up and my right shoulder to stop bothering me a little bit. So, but it's available now, yeah, in the App Store.
And, you know, I think the power of biosensors is something that I think gives us insight beyond anything that we can even do within healthcare. It makes me also just listening to just how powerful the app is integrated with the information you fed it and biosensors, whether we need physicians in the future, like listening to you.
It's interesting that you say, Sharon. So in my mind, it's interesting when we think about AI and replacing things. So you think about chess, like they were thought that AI wouldn't beat the best chess player, like maybe ever. And then it did. But the best chess player in the world now isn't AI or a human. It's the combination of the two, centaurs. And so that's how we use it in our practice. And like when somebody has this app, I say, absolutely, you still need a doctor. It's the combination of a physician and then this health coach that you get 2 o'clock in the morning. If you wake up and you can't sleep, you're not going to text your doctor, but you can tell the app, I'm having trouble sleeping. Give me a recommendation. I may give you a yoga nidra recommendation or a meditation, something, or talk to you, something like that. So I think they supplement each other really well, because it certainly is not doing any diagnosis or recommended medications or things either.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there's something about how I think we as humans are wired to respond to human interaction and how we communicate that I don't necessarily think that is going to be replaced by the app, but there are certainly human limitations that we have as well. And I think that the marriage of the two is also where I see this all going. So I completely agree. Compared to biomarkers, if a patient goes to their doctor, they're going to get a certain battery of tests. They're going to have their blood sugar checked, their cholesterol checked, and some basic level of testing. And if they have access to maybe more detailed testing, they may get a few additional tests to look at their metabolic health or cardiovascular risk. How much does the biologic testing or even epigenetic testing add to what we're already capable of getting that's already been happening?
Yeah, so I'll answer that two ways. The pace of aging, I really like, and I used that before I was associated with True Diagnostic, because it's a great integrator of everything. So I like the precision of the specific test about the why, but it's a really good global marker to follow because age is the number one risk factor for all chronic disease. So that's great. In the future, you're going to get a lot more precision, though. So you and I were talking about epigenetic research. So there was a study published on Sunday that kind of confirmed a hypothesis that we had. And we actually just did a study with Harvard. We've been doing it for a while. We haven't published yet, so I can't talk about the specific results. But we had this hypothesis. We were seeing a lot of things coming out. Remember how I said you could predict the smoking, the zip codes, the potentially like neurosyphilis, biologic age. Well, what you can predict with epigenetics, I think, is only limited by your imagination, the size of the data set. So we used Harvard's 100,000 patient biobank. And what we did is we would take 2,000 patients with cardiovascular disease or with depression and find the epigenetic fingerprint of those. And I remember where I was when we got the results. And I'll always remember the time. I was blown away. And the other thing that we found is you can have these epigenetic biomarker proxies. So there's a study by Marioni. He looked at CRP. CRP versus the imputed or predicted CRP with DNA methylation. And he found that actually the imputed CRP had better hazard ratios or correlated more closely with some outcomes like cognitive impairment that inflammation should drive. So when we looked at about 4,000 biomarkers to see if we could predict these biomarkers, And we just isolated about 300 that will publish the studies. And actually, I shouldn't really talk about the results too much when it's not published yet. But I'll tell you, I'm excited about those two. So I think in the future with epigenetics, we're going to be able to give a lot of precision about a lot of things. Right now, the pace of aging is great. But in the future, I think DNA methylation is going to, and epigenetics is going to take over a lot of diagnostics based on the signal that we're seeing with hazard ratios in association to disease.
I can see that, Matt. It actually ties into something you mentioned earlier related to smoking, right? You can ask someone, what's your smoking history? And they can tell you from recall how many years they smoked, roughly how much they smoked, and maybe it was 20 years ago and they're estimating it. But maybe they also had some passive smoking exposure and they lived in a household where their parents smoked. When we are looking at it at an epigenetic level, we're really seeing the imprint on the DNA from the smoking exposure, which is going to say this is really the net result of what you recall as smoking and maybe some exposure that you may have had that you may not have been aware of or calculated into your personal risk. So I can understand how the utility of being able to measure the marks that have been left behind on your DNA from this exposure can be more powerful than our current method, which is largely, here's a questionnaire, tell us what you did in the past and how we're going to be able to move that forward in a pretty dramatic way to kind of drill down on the impact.
That's a really great point. The word you used of biologic effect, I think, is important. And to give an example, just to key off your example, which was great, is alcohol. So alcohol in general, we know it's a toxin. It has negative effects, but it affects everyone differently. So there are these specific DNA methylation predictors and algorithms too that will look at the effect alcohol has had on you. And so when we look at how much people drink, whether it's one drink a day or two drinks a week or whatever it is, they'll report the amount, but it affects people differently. And so we can also look at the effect the alcohol is having. And then you can see things like maybe one drink a night is really having a negative effect on someone, whereas someone else, based on their metabolism or everything, two drinks maybe isn't. So it's that biologic effect. And that, the CRP example I gave you is a perfect example of that. So CRP, even though it should correlate with cognitive impairments, it's an inflammatory marker, it's up and down all over the place, like glucose. So when you plot it against cognitive impairment, the scatter plots everywhere, it doesn't correlate. But the CRP methylated does correlate. So it's probably more like glucose to hemoglobin A1C. So if I was to take someone's spot glucose, it doesn't tell me much because it's all over the place. But I like A1C because it's an average over time. It's more of the biologic effect. So with DNA methylation, when you get these markers around alcohol, smoking, or even other lab tests, you're seeing the biologic effect, which is probably a more important marker than the one-time marker of whatever it is we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, kind of ties to how we started this episode. We are all so individually different that and I'm thinking of stress as you're mentioning, those two people can undergo the same amount of stress in their life and how it impacts one person is going to be dramatically different than the other person. And the biological effect of it will be very different too. So this ability to measure the biological effect, taking into account all of our individual variances, is again, just a brave new world of where we're headed with all of the capability in healthcare. And Matt, with the time we have left, is there anything you want to mention about the testing or how we utilize a testing? Anything else you'd like to add that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
Not about the testing. I will say anytime we're talking about like health span and biologic age and things like that, I always feel like it's really important to remind people what I think is the most important component. My favorite study on this was the Harvard study where they looked over 80 years at thousands of people. And we've been talking about smoking and alcohol, and those things have a negative impact. But the thing that was by far the most impactful, someone's listening to this and they don't want any of the technology or the testing, it was the strength of your social relationships and connection. And I just, anytime we talk about longevity and health span, I just like to remind people that if you focus on one thing and one thing only, it's connection and your relationships. That's going to make the biggest impact on your health span and happiness.
Yeah, that's such a great point, Matt. And thanks for kind of bringing it full circle, because I think sometimes we get into these really concrete things that we can do, like eat X amount of servings of this and three servings of that and this supplement, and then this is your workout routine. And we can control these variables, but the things that we often find more intangible or more subjective are the things that impact our aging. And like you mentioned, our relationships, love, stress, resilience, like these factors are just so important. And I think sometimes because they're harder to quantitate and control, we don't really invest the time or give them a level playing field with some of these more objective markers. So I'm very glad you mentioned that. So Matt, it's been a pleasure. How can people learn more? I do want to attach the show notes links to maybe the app that you mentioned, the Hollis app, and how people can get the biologic age testing if they're interested, just so we can have people have the access. And is there anywhere else that they can find more about this information or about you that you'd like to share?
Sure. Yeah. So the app is H-O-L-I-S, Hollis. It's in the iOS App Store. TrueDiagnostic.com is where the biologic age tests are. WildHealth.com is where you can find more out about Wild Health. That's where I am in those two companies. I'm too old really to be on social media a ton, so I don't really have any social media handles or anything, but those places is where I work and where I'm committed to trying to increase as many people's health span as possible.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.